I want to welcome everybody to Polar Connect, a program that we have for connecting you with Arctic researchers from around the world. And today we have a special program where we're going to be talking with teacher Claude Larson and the team that has been and is still in Kamchatka, Russia, where Claude was. They were working on prehistoric human response to climate change, a project that they're going to explain more about. It's Friday, September 10th here in the United States, and it's a whole other day in Kamchatka, and a very early morning for the researchers that are there, but we're glad they're here. Before we hear from the research team and from Claude about this whole project, we want to introduce you to the platform that we're using today. It's called Horizon Wimba. If you are on a computer somewhere in the world, you will see the slides changing in the center of your screen, and you will also see that there's a list of participants in the bottom right-hand corner. We have a chat feature that's associated with this platform, and you can ask your questions there or comment and say hi to various people. You can do it to the whole room, or you can use the pull-down menu and do it to individuals. As we go along, if you have any troubles, you can chat with us and let Kristen and myself, Janet, know that you're having trouble, or you can try exiting and going into the lobby, either one, and see if that resolves the situation. This event is being archived and will be available later today. When it comes to asking questions, if you're using voice over IP, you'll need to hold down the talk button the entire time you're talking and then release it. And if you're joining us by phone and you have a lot of background noise going on, we ask you to mute your phones by pressing *6 to mute and *6 to unmute. I think that's got it. And if you have questions as you go along, you can use the little hand icon to raise your hand. Real quickly, we're going to do a quick roll call. And actually, I know where most people are from, but please, for the people that don't have a computer, and please state your name, where you're from, and the number of people that are joining you. And we're going to start with the Pink Palace. I know you don't have voice. And Pink Palace Museum says that they have two people right now, and they have their place open so others may come and go. We have Jefferson Middle High School, and I don't know, Claude, do you want to tell us how many people and where they're all based at your school?
Our half of our 7th grade and our entire 8th grade is at the high school auditorium, and our entire 6th grade is in the media center, and all told, we have about 700 kids listening today.
All right, so welcome, Jefferson. I don't see Gloria Becknergon. Is Gloria there? Okay, she registered. Rebecca and Ezra, why don't you introduce yourselves again?
Hi, I'm Ezra Zubrow. I'm the project director for International Center, International Circumpolar Archaeological Project, and I just want to say I'm very pleased that all of you are listening. And that Claude was, from everything I have heard, just the most remarkable teacher we have ever had on a polar expedition that I've been involved with. You have a remarkable person there.
I'm Rebecca Miller. I'm one of Ezra's graduate students, and I was in Kamchatka with Claude. And we also have two other people here at Buffalo listening with us.
Okay. Great, welcome. Another person has signed up, Michael Wing. He might join us in a little bit. He was a polar truck teacher that went out with Ezra last year. But I don't think, Michael, you're on? I don't think so. Okay, and then Eva, can you introduce yourself?
Hi, everyone. My name is Eva Holt, and I am a postdoctoral researcher on the Kamchatka Project. I didn't get to go out with them this year, but I did go last year, so I know some of the things that they're talking about, and I'm looking forward to hearing the real story from this year. I'm the only person on my end that's participating over here.
Okay. And besides the research team and Claude, do we have any other people that I haven't called that snuck on the phone. Okay. Fantastic. So we're going to move on to what is Polar Trek and why the heck Claude was out there in Kamchatka with these researchers. So Polar Trek is a program that stands for Teachers and Researchers Exploring and Collaborating, and it's a program where we place teachers with researchers in the Arctic and the Antarctic, and they get to experience hands-on science with them. And we've been doing this for a little while. We started in 2007, and we have a new program that's funded by the National Science Foundation. And our goal in the next 4 years is to place 50 teachers from around the United States, teachers like Claude and others, in the Arctic and the Antarctic, so they can learn more about the science and come back to the classroom and share that science with their students and with their communities. And so that was the program that, this is the program that Claude joined, and that's how she got connected with this research team. To give you a sense of place, we have a map up about where this field work occurred, and we'll hear from the research team and Claude in a moment about more details about this. But you can see on the map we have Alaska and Canada, and I'm sorry we don't have Jefferson or some of these other places. You're off the map and to the east there. And you can see that Kamchatka Peninsula is way down there at the, it sticks out on a little panhandle out of off of Russia. And they're neighbors with us here in Fairbanks in Alaska. So they're our neighbors. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Claude and Greg. And Claude, we're starting with the title slide.
Okay, so we're on the title slide?
Correct.
Great. Okay, first thing I want to say about Polar Trek and this whole experience, for those of you who are sports fans out there, this is like the X Games of science expeditions. Everything was extreme. You think like, you know, motocross and other crazy things that these X Games athletes do. Well, these scientists were like those athletes in the science world. They go truly to the ends of the earth to study their science. And everything was extreme. We had to ride tanks. There was snow in the middle of July. You know, roughing it is to put it mildly, because these guys were just absolutely extreme scientists as far as I'm concerned. And it was such a pleasure to be with them because it was very exciting. Can we move to the next slide?
Yep.
Okay. This adventure, you see where Kamchatka was, they're way at the end of Russia. We got to Kamchatka by plane, because I don't believe there's any roads that go there. And we landed in a city called Petropavlovsk, which, as you can see right there, that city street is at the base of volcanoes. So this whole peninsula is just loaded with volcanoes, some of them erupting, all of them just beautiful to look at. It was spectacular scenery. And from this very remote location, we hired a bus. And we all got on the bus with all of our stuff, our gear, our equipment, all that stuff, and drove on an unpaved road. So if you think about how bouncy the school bus is on a paved road getting you home, now imagine being on a bus and the whole road is not paved. So you're bouncing along. We went for about 9 hours like that. And there were rivers that we had to cross that no longer had bridges because ice had taken them away, or you know, the weather is so extreme that they were damaged. We actually had to take our bus and put it on ferries so that we could get across the river. Can we go to the next slide? Okay. And this is just to show you. I mean, you saw the large picture of Russia with the little peninsula at the end. This map is just the peninsula itself. And the first map is just the peninsula. The center one is where we started. That was the city of Petropavlovsk. And from there, we went 9 hours north, stopped, did some work for a couple of days, and continued 5 hours further north until we finally ended up, if you look at the picture on the extreme right, at the very top of that peninsula, we ended up in a place called Stolbovaya. Next slide. So after our 9-hour bus ride, we arrived at, this is what we consider the 5-star hotel there, the top picture on the left-hand side. That was our 5-star hotel. And it had no running water or electricity, but it was actually quite comfortable to stay in. This was in a place called Ushki. And because we had to travel so far, we couldn't bring a lot of things with us. There's just certain things you can't transport on a plane. So if you look on the right-hand side, that's me and a young man named Sean Paul, who's a graduate student. He and I were building screens, and in the background you can see the screens. Those are actually used for sifting through the dirt so that we could find artifacts that had been buried for thousands of years. And while we were at Ushki, we also reviewed maps. We made a plan. Where were we going to go? Where were we going to look? And Greg, who is, I'm wearing the orange baseball cap there. He is just to my right, and he's obscured by me, which I apologize for that shot. But he had actually spent a very long time looking at the shoreline and the topography, where were the higher elevations and things like that, and picking locations that would be best for digging. And he spent a lot of time doing that, which was really what created the success in the project, because it was well thought out and we knew where we were going. Okay, next slide. So after Ushki, we get back on a bus and we load up all our gear and we go to a city called Ust-Kamchatsk, which is pretty much like a commercial fishing village, really. And I'm sitting there with my orange baseball cap. You see all the stuff that was on the bus. So along with 12 people, there was also all this other stuff loaded on there with us. So it wasn't a particularly comfortable ride, and it certainly wasn't on a paved road. But we were happy to get there because waiting for us was, if you look to the right, a nice big Vesdy hood, which is what the Russians' word is for a tank. And we loaded that tank onto a barge with all of our stuff, and we headed up into on the Ust-Kamchatka River, or the Kamchatka River, excuse me. And so a boat was pulling all our stuff and all of us and this tank. We went for a couple of hours, and if we go to the next slide. Okay. As we were moving along, suddenly the winds picked up, and one of the lines snapped that was holding the barge, so that was a little problematic. We actually had to turn back. We had to find a safe place to pull over, and we all disembarked. We were going to wait out the winds, see if the winds settled and we could continue. It was decided that we would not continue, so everybody sort of dug out their gear, pitched their tent, and we stayed on the side of the mouth of this river. Just making do until the weather changed. Now, the following day, the weather changed. It was spectacular. We continued up the waterway, and we got to a point called Kultuk, where we all strapped our stuff to the tank, to the Vesdy hood, and we took it over very remote terrain. If you look to the picture on the right, that's what we were going over. And if there was a tree in our way, we just mowed it down with the tank. And if there were bushes in our way, we just kept going. There was essentially a road, but, if you didn't know where it was, it wasn't like you could pick it out. I guess the Vesdy hood driver knew where it was. But we basically went on basically a 3-hour ride that felt like being on a mechanical bull. Okay, so next slide. So on the tank ride, we ran into a little bit of trouble. The tank got sort of sank partway into some muck, and we ended up being stranded for just a little bit of time. Our Vesdy hood driver was quite experienced, got us out of our predicament, got us on our way. You see there Sean Paul giving the double thumbs up because we were just thinking like, wow, this is awesome. We're stuck in the middle of a bog on this tank, and nobody really quite knew what to do. So thank goodness the driver had some experience. Okay, next slide. Okay, so, we've gone all this way. We've traveled far and wide, And finally, we get to do some science. The picture on the left, in the standing down on the bottom, is Jody Bourgeois. She was a geologist who was with us from the University of Washington in Seattle. And she brought us down onto the beach, and what we actually did was we sort of chopped off the front of the beach outcropping. And when we did that, we exposed the layers of soil that were underneath. So if you look to the right, those are what the layers of soil look like. And there's very distinct bands of lighter soil. Some is a little orangey, some is a little light gray. And these are layers of soil that are actually volcanic ash that was laid down during volcanic eruptions. So if you can imagine, you know, a band 2 or 3 inches thick of soil, how much ash had to have been in the sky when a volcano like that would have erupted that it leaves such a distinct band. And the bands had been researched previously, and they know the dates of when those eruptions occurred. And several of the bands actually came from the same volcano, which we could see in the distance from our field camp. It was called Shivelich. And Shivelich would put these, you know, would have these massive eruptions, and there would be bands of ash. And they actually name them different names. So I think of it as if Shivelich is the mom, each of her layers of ash, which we call tephra once they're down on the ground, it's kind of like each of her children and their different ages, and they give them different names so they can tell the difference, because obviously your mother, if you have more than one child, they give them different names so they can tell you apart, you know, who your mother's calling. Okay, next slide. Okay, and Jody continued to give us some geology lessons, and even though this looks, to kids in the Northeast, this would look like quite a punishment, to dig a hole that's, you know, 1 meter on each side and maybe 3 or 4 feet deep. We would have a very hard time here because the soil is so rocky. But in Kamchatka, the soil does not have rocks in it. If you hit a rock, a human put it there. So actually hitting a rock was a good thing, because then you'd get excited. Perhaps you had found an artifact. And after we had done a little bit more geology work, we started looking for pit houses that prehistoric people had lived in. And Greg described them, and he kept telling me about them, and everything I stumbled across, I thought, oh, is this one? Is this one? And I really had no idea what I was looking for until suddenly his exact description came right before me. I was walking. Next thing I know, I was down in a depression. It was circular. It was maybe 20 meters wide. And I realized this was a pit house. Now, a pit house is when prehistoric people, they dig a big hole and they build a roof over the top. And when the house is no longer used, the roof collapses and you get this big depression. And that's how you know that somebody used to live there. So I was feeling pretty victorious there. I got my arms up in the air. I was really happy to have found one, and I knew exactly what I was looking for. And it turned out, it actually turned out to be a pretty good one, because we found a lot of stuff there. Okay, next slide. Okay. Okay, so once we found a depression, you see Greg there at the top, we would mark it with surveying tape, and that way we could always locate it again. We also marked it with GPS. And if you look at the picture at the bottom, that's me standing along the ridgeline. We would walk the ridgeline along the river there, and it was about 35 to 40 meters higher than the ground below it, but that's where all the homes were, because back then, thousands of years ago, the water came up to the base of that terrace, and now the water had receded. So that's where we were finding all of our homes. Next slide. Okay, and then we would find these depressions in clusters. Sometimes there'd be 3 or 5 or 7. And Greg, who had the most knowledge of all of us, was basically directing us and saying, okay, this is where we're going to dig. So he would pick 1 or 2 out of all the depressions in a cluster, and he would pick what section we were going to dig. And we'd start digging a hole, and that's me in the blue. I am, you can pick me out in every picture because I'm the only person there who didn't have camouflage clothing. But that's me down. I was shaking one of the screens that we had built at Ushki. We'd carry those with us while we walked along the ridge. And I believe that's Leosha. He was digging. They had some Russian students there with us who were very nice. He would dig in the hole, put the dirt in the screen. I would shake it. The dirt would fall through, and then artifacts and different things would pop up out of the dirt, which was very exciting. It was just like a big treasure hunt. In order to find where we were going to dig, if you look at that bottom picture, Greg would sometimes take a core sample. And it was just a silver cylinder. You'd push it down into the soil. Again, there's not a lot of rocks there, so it was relatively easy to do. And we would scan it to see if we could find charcoal, which was very distinct black soil. And charcoal was a great thing to find because you would know that prehistoric people had had a fire there, and you had found a home, and that it would be a good place to dig. So core sampling was very important.
Excuse me, Claude, we have a question, and Greg, feel free to jump in here. A visitor at the Pink Palace wants to know how many people lived in these communities at the time.
Greg, that would be for you.
It's a difficult question. Estimating populations in the past is very difficult. I have Dustin and Irina here who can offer up their own opinion. These people were probably fairly mobile. They probably were in relatively small bands. In ethnographic examples, we see, up to 10 people living in one dwelling. Of course, whether or not that was true in the prehistoric past as well, it's very difficult to say.
Okay.
It would depend on how many depressions, how many dwellings are in the site. Some have only one or two depressions, some have as many as a few.
Yeah, there were different numbers of depressions for different sites. There probably wasn't a standard. But ethnographic examples suggest that they were relatively small groups. Anybody else have an opinion? Yeah, that's our line on the matter.
Okay.
All right, thanks.
Because it was very quiet over here. Did you say up to 15 in a group? Up to 15 depressions in a settlement?
Yeah.
Okay, can we go to the next?
Okay?
Yeah, yes. We can hear you. Dustin was a little quiet. He needs to get closer to the phone when you guys talk.
Okay, go ahead.
Surprise. Okay, next slide. It's interesting that you guys asked that question, how many people, and their answer is, well, it's hard to tell, because my next slide are some of the artifacts that we took out of some of the excavation pits. At the top, I'm actually holding bone fragments, and I learned while I was there that the reason those bone fragments lasted was they had probably come from animals that they had cooked. So by heating the bones in a fire, it hardened them enough to last. Now, obviously, the human bones probably did not get heated in a fire, which is why it may be difficult to tell. Greg, does that sound reasonable?
Yeah, that's fairly accurate.
Okay. So the bone fragments are at the top, and then at the bottom there were these things called flakes, and it's when you hit two stones together and a piece of the stone that you're hitting breaks off into a flake, and they have some very distinct qualities. They have a sharp edge. They'll have like a semicircular fracture on them, and they'll actually be a little bulge on one side. And then you know that you have a flake. If it has all those three features, you're sure of it. And we would collect those because that would show that that was where they were in the process of making stone tools. We also found some really nice stone tools. If you look over on the right, that's called a projectile point by scientists. I know some of you, Boy Scouts and people who collect these kinds of things, it may be called arrowheads, but since they weren't always used for arrows, we call them projectile points in science. Okay, next slide.
Yep, and Claude and Greg, we have a couple of questions from Jefferson. The first one was, what's the temperature at night?
Oh, at night. Well, I actually had bought a little thermometer. It was actually a multi-purpose kind of thing, and it happened to have a thermometer on it. I know that there were some mornings where inside my tent, where it was warmer than outside of my tent, it was 40 degrees Fahrenheit. So there were definitely some mornings that were in the 30s. And it would, as soon as the sun got at a certain angle, the temperature would drop pretty rapidly. You'd be looking for your polar fleece jacket. But after a while, you got used to it. At first, I was pretty cold, and then, I guess your body just starts burning at a higher temperature, and you feel like it gets pretty comfortable, even though if I had been at home and not in that environment, I'm sure I would have thought it was just freezing outside. But there, you just got used to it.
And then another question from Jefferson is, from the artifacts that you've seen, how far back can you date human life back to? So probably Greg.
Yeah.
Well, I think any of my colleagues can answer this question just as well as I could. But in this setting, difficult to establish a date precise based upon artifacts simply because so little archaeology has been done in the region. We rely more heavily on the tephra, volcanic tephra layers, to date any particular site. In the case of the depression that Claude found, by looking at the tephra, we were able to establish that that site was, in its earliest iteration, as old as 4,000 years, perhaps a bit younger. But it's difficult to use artifacts here. Again, because there hasn't been any other finds upon which to base a topology.
And related to that, Greg, the Jefferson also wants to know, what was the most interesting artifact that you have found?
Ooh, we might all have a different answer for this.
I think we probably would. I don't know. We found some really nice axe heads, some really nice projectile points, also known as arrowheads. For me, my favorite's got to be an obsidian arrowhead that I found. It's so clear, the material that it's made out of, that you can see through it like glass.
Oh, cool.
Totally intact. It was quite beautiful.
Wow.
I don't know if anybody else has that one, but that's fine.
How about you? I think you may... Go ahead.
Yeah, we found that the day after you...
The day after I figured. I was going to say, I did not see that. That sounds spectacular. My favorite was the one Irina found. It was very small. It was chalcedony. It was white. It was a little white projectile point. But, it was like the size of like the end of your pinky finger, but it was perfect in every way. So somebody had obviously done, a very careful, meticulous job of making that projectile point, because I thought that one was just really special. Plus, it was so small, I can't believe we found it.
Okay, cool. All right, closed.
Okay, next slide. Yeah, I'm getting towards the end here. Next slide. This is some people working on an excavation. We have Jody on the left and Rebecca Miller, who's online with us here. This was I'm sort of fond of this excavation because this was the first depression that I ever found. So, because I was so proud of myself at that moment, when they ended up digging in there, they actually found a hearth, like an entire stone hearth where the fire had been. And we started with, you know, a small hole, and it just got bigger and bigger and bigger while they excavated it out. And on the right-hand side, there's Jody Geology there. She dug a hole as deep as she is tall, and she's over 5 feet tall. And she dug all the way down through all the layers of tephra, down to the base, which was at some point like the sea floor. And she estimated that the soil layers there went up to about 10,000 years of age. So that's just the kind of stuff that was going on there. One more slide, and then we'll take questions. Okay, when we would find stuff out in the field, we would put it in a little plastic bag. We would label where we found it, at what depth we found it. You know, the location, we had started naming the sites, Doldavia 1, 2, 3, and so on. And then we'd bring them back, and Rebecca, amongst other things, was in charge of cleaning them, rebagging them in a clean bag, and making sure that all the information that we had about them was accurate so they could be cataloged for museums and for university use.
Okay. Hey, while you're pausing there, we have another question about where was the best place that you dug? What was the best place that you've dug so far?
Oh, great. What did you guys found stuff after I left?
From my opinion, Claude, it had to be the set of depressions that you found. We ended up doing a big area excavation there with trenches and wider open area excavations. Later on in the season, we did other excavations that produced really interesting artifacts closer to Uskumchas. But my favorite spot has got to be the one that you found.
Well, thank you.
Nice.
Great.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
Okay. Do you have any other questions out there?
No, the other questions relate to life in the field, so I'm going to let you cover that.
Oh, okay. Oh, you want me to? Okay, sure. I can keep going. I've got tons of slides. Okay, next slide. All right. So for those of you who are all wondering, yes, it was extremely remote. On the left is our bathroom, very nice and private. Actually, when you stood up in there, everybody knew that you were in there, which was kind of good because nobody would walk in and surprise you. And on the right-hand side was where we took a shower, which we almost never used. We pretty much just went down to the nice, icy, cold river that was a little less than 40 degrees Fahrenheit. And when you really couldn't stand it anymore, it was better to go into 40 degrees of water than it was to walk around smelling like you were smelling at that point in time. So those were our bathroom and shower facilities. Next slide. This was where we ate generally around. There was a fire pit where we had a fire going a lot of the time. And behind it was the cooking tent where all the food was stored. You can see the food that we had there. At the top picture, way over to the left, that was the work tent. So when you had work to do and you wanted to be out of the location of the relentless mosquitoes that were upon us every day. These mosquitoes, by the way, were just unbelievable. Like, it would be raining and there would still be mosquitoes out biting you. And you're kind of thinking, how is this possible? Aren't they supposed to go somewhere else? So pretty much we ate outside. We ate outside if it was raining. We ate outside if it was sunny. Pretty much that was the stuff there. Next slide.
Real quick, a question about the food. What kind of food were you eating?
Oh, you know what? Jump to slide, I want to say 29.
Okay.
You have that?
I found it, yeah.
Yep, got it.
That's the right one? Okay, that was a typical lunch for us. We would be out in the field, and we'd have our screen with us, which sometimes we used as a table. Sometimes we just left all the food on the ground. We would heat water, and we'd have these things called doshi racks, which are kind of like ramen noodles with different seasonings. You got different flavors, I guess. And then we would use our pocket knives and open some cans And we generally just sort of ate out of the cans and kind of passed it around. That sounds kind of strange, except that if nobody's sick, you're not going to pass germs to anybody else. And since pretty much you had no privacy anyway, sharing food was like you didn't even think about it. It was just the way it was done. So that was a field meal. And when we were back at camp, we would cook over an open fire. We had things like pasta and rice. And my least favorite thing was this chushanka, which was like this canned beef product that was I was just grateful that I was a vegetarian and that I didn't have to count on eating it. But I don't know, just little canned beef.
That was delicious.
Canned.
Come on.
Oops, somebody was trying to say something?
I don't know. Did somebody just sign on?
This is Eva. I was just saying that the chushanka is delicious.
Okay. I'll take your word on that.
No, really. I sometimes feel nostalgic about it.
Really?
Oh, that's so sad, Eva.
All right. Can we jump back to slide 17?
Sure. We're there.
Okay. Our drinking water, we got that from the stream nearby camp, and it was not filtered. We just took a bucket. Right there we see Stas. He was one of the students that was there with us, just pulling some water out of the stream. We put it in a container, or you could just take your water bottle, fill it up right there. Pretty much that was our water supply. And then to the right, that was our little tent city. Most people had their own tent. I believe the professors and the adults had their own tent. Some of the students shared a tent, two or three in a tent. But you had a place to go when you kind of wanted to be off on your own. You could just go to your tent. It wasn't, private in the sense like, you have a door and nobody knows that you're in there or whatever. But at least, you had a place to go, and it was reasonably comfortable for tenting.
We had a question from the Pink Palace. They wanted to know, with all that food, how did you keep the animals away? And mostly bears. And
oh, okay. Skip to slide 18. I guess the next slide coming up. We had a couple things, actually. First, the bears in Kamchatka are grizzly bears, and they have actually been sort of programmed by humans. They do not want to come near humans, and they do not associate humans with food. We were very careful whenever we brought food out to the field. We took everything and we burned it so that there would be no food product left. And they basically don't want to come near humans because Kamchatka is a tourist destination where people go to shoot grizzly bears for trophies and things like that. So they don't want to come near us, but if they do, we at all times were carrying with us a bear flare, which is this orange sort of baton here. You unscrew the cap, you pull the string that has the metal ring on it, it makes a really loud noise, and then it burns a big red flare that generally scares them off.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions?
We'll see. So we're at the end of a closed show here, and as far as slides, so if you guys have questions, I know we've been answering some as we went along, but if you have additional questions, you can type them in, or if you have, Jefferson, if you have access to a microphone, you can even ask your questions. While they're getting ready here, we had a question from Jefferson. Did you bring back any for Jefferson to use on our black bears? Oh, the flares. Did you bring back the flares?
You know what? I left them behind only because everybody only had one, and I felt like if somebody ended up having to use theirs, then there would be somebody there who didn't have one. So I left mine behind. I took pictures, but, it's interesting because half of it is written in Russian and the other half is the English translation, which, as we know, sometimes when one is translated to the other, it's just sort of comical the way they put it. But it's basically, it's intended to give a distress signal, and it really does do a good job of scaring off bears.
Another question, did you see any other animals?
Yes, I saw a stellar eagle. They are huge. And one day I had taken a walk down on the beach because there was a river alongside us, and then at the end of the river, at the mouth of the river, there was the Bering Sea. So you could walk all the way to the Bering Sea. It wasn't very far, but you could see stellar eagles soaring overhead. They were really beautiful. And there actually was an old military outpost there, and one of the eagles had made a gigantic nest on the top of it, and we had seen that while we were excavating nearby.
Another question, how was the weather during the day? Did it rain a lot? Maybe we'll hear from Greg and the team.
Oh,
maybe that was the beep. That might have connected.
The weather was cold in the mornings, but then it depended during the day. If it was really sunny, it might actually get up into the 70s, but if it was rainy, it would probably stay like in the 40s, so you'd be just sort of cold and damp. We had rain gear, so as long as you had enough layers on and you kept your rain gear on, you just sort of kept yourself dry enough. There were definitely some days of rain. A lot of mornings there was that morning maritime fog that would come in off the Bering Sea. But overall, I thought the weather was not bad. And a saying that I have determined from this whole adventure is, there is no bad weather, there is only bad clothing.
Yep, the Norwegians would agree with you.
Absolutely.
Greg, I assume that was you that beeped off and came back on?
Yep, we're back online. Sorry about that.
Okay, well, we have a question for you from Jefferson. This is more about animals again. They want to know, what are the different kinds of animals that you find in Russia? So, I don't know, you've been there a couple times. Maybe you can explain what you've seen.
Greg, you want to field that one? Because I just know the grizzly bears.
Well, I mean, by Russia, I assume you mean Kamchatka specifically. In Kamchatka, it depends on what part of Kamchatka you're in. But there's grizzly bears, there's reindeer, there's moose, there's wolves, there's seals. What else is there?
I forgot about that. Those
lots
seals.
Lots of different birds.
Yeah.
Yep,
the seals would come out almost every day.
Okay.
Yeah.
And another question for you, Greg, is how were you able to communicate with your family or friends and family? And we'll let you guys all field that question.
Well, I can start by saying that we had a satellite phone, actually two of them. Once every few weeks or so, we would let people give a call, even if only for a few seconds, to their family, and just say, hey, I'm okay, I'm alive. It was great to have those sat phones. So we used them mostly for emergency only.
Okay, close.
I had a sat phone, and I was sort of the sat phone queen, I guess. I used the generator every night to make sure it was charged, and I want to say just about every day, I would connect a satellite antenna to my laptop computer. I could email stories to Alaska and some pictures back that they all put on the internet for me over there. Ronnie took care of that. And I did make, I made a phone call to my family to say, like, okay, I have arrived and, you will be seeing stuff on the internet shortly and things like that, because I knew that I had not communicated to them for several days, and I'm sure they were concerned about me. I used it, to call a couple of other times, once to my family and a couple times to Alaska just to talk with Janet and Kristen, and it was very handy to have, and I was basically up. I was one of the first people out of my tent in the morning, so I would just set it up upload my emails, download my emails, and, you know, so I think I probably used it more than anybody else there.
Okay, and some other questions that have come up, so about communication. How did you communicate with the Russian people? Did you know a lot of Russian?
Greg, do you want to take that one?
Yeah, I can answer that. And Irina's sitting here, so she'll laugh. We would very often communicate in what we like to call Ruslish. It's, you know, I speak a bit of Russian, and all the Russians speak a bit of English, and between the two, we were able to communicate quite well. And the fact that we're all in the same field, we're all archaeologists, and whether you're a Russian or an American, the methods that you use are more or less the same. So frequently, even when you didn't know the word for something, you know, in terms of archaeology, you could just sort of gesture to one of the students, and it would be easily figured out. What's more is Irina and Sasha, who is also with us. Sasha is another professor from Magadan. They speak English perfectly. So communication was sometimes a challenge, but mostly quite easy.
Yeah. And I would say Irina did a lot of translating. If we were telling a story or asking something, she knows so much English that she would translate it for the Russian students so that they would understand either the story that we were telling or the directions that we were giving. So she was a great translator for us.
Okay, another question. This is for Claude. Would you go back and do it again?
Oh, I absolutely would. It was spectacularly beautiful there. It was really interesting. Everybody who was there was just so nice to me, went out of their way to help me because, you know, I'm not an archaeologist, so they were very patient. They taught me how to do things. And, you know, I had my own little personal victories when I would find things, and I got excited every single time I saw a volcano erupt. Yeah, I would definitely go back. It was amazing.
Speaking of this, so what is the most exciting thing you experienced while you were there? So let's go to the research team and ask them that, and then we'll come to you, Claude.
Okay.
I suppose I can go first. I mean, everything's been exciting to me. I mean, this is what I do. Every day here brings new things, new experiences that you've never seen before. For example, three or four days ago at Ushki, we had twin volcanic eruptions at the same time over the site, including lava fountain. And this was at night, so it was really impressive, and I'd never seen anything like that before on any of my previous travels. And that's the kind of thing that we encounter on a day-to-day basis. It's always something new. You know, riding around in tanks is exciting. You know, just being in bear country is exciting. It's all exciting to me.
Okay, how about Justin? Yeah, how about your others that are there?
Well, the most exciting thing for me this season has been seeing so many bears, quite a few in the field, and some of them pretty close.
One of our students got within 6 meters of a bear that snuck up on him during lunch preparation. So after that, we were a little more vigilant for several days.
Yeah, we have a slide that Claude sent us with a bear track and a shovel up, and it's, since I've worked in bear country, that's a pretty impressive track.
Yeah, that was, do you have that pulled up?
Yes.
Yeah, I actually, after I took that picture, I learned that that's not the bear's entire foot. They walk on their toes.
That's right.
So that's about half the length. So if you think about, you know, a garden shovel, rather large shovel there, the footprint was impressive. And in fact, when you would walk on the beach, this was kind of interesting. I was, because I'm an early morning person, I would go down there and the tide would have come up in the middle of the night and come back down. And just about every morning there were fresh bear tracks out there. And I actually, you know, there was one day where I saw three different size bear tracks, at which point I realized that I should probably get back to field camp because I probably shouldn't be where three grizzlies had been in the past, you know, little bit of time. But, you know, and, you know, I have to echo Greg on the whole, like, what's exciting. Like, every day you just did not know what was going to happen, and that made it really exciting. You know, will I see a bear? Will I find something really cool? Riding a tank was pretty amazing, actually. You know, it just, you never knew what to expect, and there were a lot of really nice surprises out there that just, you know, looking back, I looked back on my pictures, and there were just so many really cool moments. And when you sit and really think about how many exciting things happened over that span of time, it is hard to pick just one because for different reasons, all of them were really, really amazing.
Okay. I just queried the audience to see if there's any more questions from Jefferson or anybody. Nothing from the auditorium. And the other groups have also been pretty good about posting their questions. So they, since everybody can't talk, they're all saying, we enjoyed following your adventure and thank you very much. So I think with that, we're going to wrap it up here. If you do have additional questions, you guys all know where to find Claude, and he can still post things online, and the research team and Claude will still respond to them. So thank you, Greg and Dustin and Irina and Rebecca and Eva and everybody else from the team. It was great to hear from you, and thanks, Claude, for pulling this all together.